Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Dr. William F. Miller, one of the world's foremost authorities on business strategy, technology, innovation, research, entrepreneurship, international development, and thought leadership. Bill, you bring a lifetime of proven top-ranking international thought leadership, global technology business strategy experience, and innovation. This is combined with substantial contributions to the worldwide technology ecosystem through your sustained history of considerable successes. Considering your very busy schedule, we thank you for doing this interview with us today.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much. It's my great pleasure, and I'm always ready to talk about China.
Can you describe your work in Asia and then your strong connection to China?
My wife and I have been going to China for more than 30 years. We first arrived in Beijing in 1976 in October during the change of power, the month after the death of Mao and the transition to Wang Guofeng as General Secretary of the Communist Party. It was a pretty exciting time to be there. There were a lot of demonstrations and so forth, and we went out and marched in the street with people, and we had a good time, but we couldn't get any business done because everything was an uproar. But I've continued those activities both while I was at Stanford and then when I was at SRI International, where I was president for 11 years. I continued a lot of interactions. We did consulting work. I became a friend of a very famous economist, Ma Hung. Ma Hung was the president of the Development Research Center for the State Council. And he and I promoted together the first international conference for the People's Republic of China in 1981. We held it in Hangzhou. And so I've continued a variety of interactions. And currently, I'm an honorary professor at Zhejiang University, and I'm also the honorary president of the Zhejiang University Innovation Institute International. So that's keeping me pretty busy with my activities in China.
So that's a considerable sort of background in terms of Asia and foreign countries, and as we mentioned, in China. And you've been helping to establish technology policies and practices within Asia.
Yes, I've worked not just in China, but in Japan, Korea, Malaysia, Singapore. I did a little work in Indonesia, not a great deal of work in Indonesia, but more in Korea, China, Taiwan as well, and Malaysia. And I've worked with the governments in helping them develop their technology policies. I've actually worked with entrepreneurs, helped create the executive education program for young entrepreneurs in Korea, and I've held a number of workshops in different areas in Taiwan and China for entrepreneurs on how you start companies and what are the criteria, what do you have to do, what are the steps, and particularly how do companies evolve.
So what kind of best practices or recommendations can you share with our audience from your years of working at the highest levels in Asia?
Well, I think there are several things that leap out at you. One, of course, education, and particularly people who are trained to do research, are very important for high-tech development. There are many developments that aren't high-tech that are also important. Agricultural developments, many of those are extremely important. But I focus myself much more on the high-tech area. And for that, you need very favorable government policies, on favorable policies on taxation, on intellectual property, on governance issues. All those are very important. And I would say one thing for high-tech that is especially important is to develop outstanding universities. I think it's very necessary to have an outstanding research university as a part of any important high-tech cluster.
You know, South Korea graduates approximately 60,000 engineers a year, the same as the U.S., though Korea is one-sixth the population. China graduates 700,000 a year, and I've seen one forecast that by 2010, 90% of the world's scientists and engineers will be in Asia. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, certainly these numbers are important, and numbers of such engineers, scientists and engineers, are really quite important, and that will have an impact, a very big impact on how science and how technology in particular develops. It is important, however, to sort out the meaning of these numbers to understand what is counted and what is not. For example, in the 700,000 Chinese graduates, that includes the students from technical schools, people with two-year degrees. So there are a lot of people counted there that would not be counted in U.S. higher education. So I think that's important. The other thing, I come back to something I mentioned a moment ago about building great universities. Until Asian countries, China in particular, develops some world-class universities, they will not get the world-class talent, and they will have to rely on world-class talent that have gone abroad to get the training. So it's important for China to develop some world-class universities. They're on the way to doing that, but it takes a long time to build world-class universities, and that'll be very important, because you need not just a large numbers of engineers, you need some of the highest trained, research-trained engineers to really compete in the global high-tech economy.
Bill, you have demonstrated world leadership in research, innovation, entrepreneurship, venture funding, nonprofits, and business. You have such an amazing diverse background in so many disciplines. What do you forecast as the leading market, technology, and business opportunities in Asia, and particularly in China?
I think there are many business opportunities there. One of the things that's very interesting is how China adopted the mobile phone much more rapidly, for example, than in the United States. And that drives a lot of things in China. The mobile phone and its various kind of forms is the most ubiquitous IT device in the world, overwhelmingly. So more needs to be done to make the mobile phone the primary IT device. So, and that's beginning to happen in China, so that's very dramatic. The other opportunities will be in various environmental areas. Those are just emerging now. The energy problems, but the environmental problems in terms of pollution, various environmental emission controls, those are important issues, and those will be of rising importance in China, and that provides opportunity not only for domestic Chinese companies, but it provides opportunity for foreign companies that have technologies to address those problems.
Can you talk about three current projects that would be of interest to our China audience, and what are the implications to China from this work?
The three current projects that I'm doing, is that your question?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, well, we have several projects. One, we are studying how clusters, high-tech clusters, form and what sustains them. I think sustainability is important. We often see high-tech clusters form, but they get very specialized and then they don't evolve. And so the sustainabilities of clusters, because it's important for Chinese clusters, high-tech clusters, to continue to evolve and reinvent themselves. In a recent workshop I did in Hangzhou, we asked a lot of the entrepreneurs there. It was a small workshop, but we asked the entrepreneurs, what were the most important issues that they faced? And the most important issues that they faced were, one, how to manage a growing company and how to compete globally. So helping Chinese entrepreneurs and Chinese business leaders understand and learn how to do that, I think, is another important project, and we're engaged in that.
Bill, you co-direct an international research project called the Stanford Project on Regions on Innovation and Entrepreneurship, and the Executive Education Program on Strategic Uses of Information Technology. Can you share three or more insights from this work?
Well, I think on the first, the study of the regions has become important, and watching these regions evolve and what are the criteria that permit them to evolve, that becomes very important. We also studied the talent, development of talent, how are Chinese companies addressing the issue that in spite of the large number of scientists and engineers who are being trained, there's still a large competition for the top talent, and how are they developing that top talent and making them capable of competing on the global scene, on the world scene. So that is an important undertaking of our SPREE project. We're also looking at other regions around the world, not just in Asia, but we're looking particularly in other parts of the United States and also in Europe, particularly in the Nordic countries, to see what are the implications of how those regions develop that would apply to regions in Asia.
So do you have sort of some underlying insights in terms of what are the motivators or what are the conditions or catalysts to create these kinds of innovation regional centers?
Yes, I think there are two parts to the equation. One is you have to have the right resources. You have to have the right talent. You have to have the right research base. Those are very important. So having the resources, you have to have the right financial base. But it's equally important to make sure that those resources are used well. And how well they're used depends upon the business, the social, and the political environment that we often refer to as the habitat. So you may have good resources, but if you don't have a favorable habitat, which means favorable policies, it means a favorable workforce, it means attitudes toward entrepreneurship, all of those are a part of that habitat. And we've seen regions that have had the resources but have not developed entrepreneurially because they didn't have a favorable habitat. So it's, I think, one of our most important insights on the development of entrepreneurial regions.
From your deep insights as Herbert Hoover Professor of Public and Private Management Emeritus, what are some of the best practices that you can share?
Well, I think some of these are well known to people, what are the best practices in management. But I think it's important to learn how to present presentation skills that are extremely important. I remember I had an important lesson at one time when I was just going into the Army, and I had this young lieutenant explain to me that the chief of staff of the armed forces had always been some general's staff officer. I asked him, why was that important? And he said, that's how you learn to get things done without much authority. And I thought that was a wonderful insight, learning how to do things without much authority, because once you do that, you have to have the persuasive powers, you have to have the analytical powers, you have to have the will to act. All those things are important. And once you have that ability, when you do get the authority, you can do even more. So it was one of the insights that I gained many years ago when I was being inducted into the Army.
So that's sort of like a core fundamental principle. So that's I seem to hear that sort of core fundamental principle when I do these interviews. So that's great to share that.
Yes, it is. You know, just being authoritarian doesn't work by itself. You have to reach out to people. It takes a lot of time. To be a good manager, it takes an enormous amount of time because you have to understand people. Another important insight I got was from reading a book was written by a psychoanalyst, Theodor Reich. It's called Listening with a Third Ear. And what he was saying is when you're talking to people, you have to listen for the music behind the words. They're not always telling you exactly what they want to tell you. And you need to be able to hear more than just the words that they're saying. That listening with a third ear was another important insight.
So it also talks about relationships, too, then, and building strong relationships networks.
Relationships, networks, those are very important. That's how you get business done.
You know, you're chairman of the board of Sentius Corp. What do you hope to achieve?
Well, I'm chairman of the board of several companies. Centius is really an IP licensing company, so that is not one that's requiring a lot of my time. I'm also a chairman and the founder of Nanostellar. Nanostellar is a company that it's a materials company that makes the catalytic materials for emission control, particularly for diesel engines, the catalytic converters for diesel engines. That is taking a great deal more of my time, and what we believe that we're able to do is that we're able to demonstrate a new way of doing chemical applications, creating chemical products, because we have a very sophisticated, rational design and rapid fabrication technique, and it is changing the way in which you go about designing materials, and we think that will be one of its main accomplishments.
So it sounds like that company is beyond sort of the angel stage and into the venture stage or even beyond that?
Yes, I would describe it as being at the expansion stage. But I've also started another company more recently. I started a lighting company, and this is very new. We haven't got everything put together yet. We're still trying to put together the manufacturing process. But this is a company that has a substitute for incandescent light. Incandescent lights are very inefficient, take a lot of energy, and you will see over time a large movement to phase out incandescent lights. Australia has already banned the sale of incandescent light bulbs after 2009, and Canada has banned the sale after 2012. You're going to see a change in California on that for new construction. So there is a search for new technologies, new lighting technologies that are much more energy efficient. And we have, we believe we have a solution to that, and we're trying to develop this company. We're just beginning to put it together. We actually formed a company about a month ago.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, you have a pretty extensive background from the venture side, so you've got this innovative idea. You've got prototypes and something like that. How do you go about getting venture funding for this idea?
Well, first you have to put together all the plans. You have to have a very good business plan, and there are a lot of particular questions you need to be able to answer that. The first thing you have to answer is, does this work? I mean, is this a workable technology? Can it scale? And can you manufacture it? All those kind of technical questions. Then the next thing you have to answer is, who wants it? Is there a market for it? Does anybody want it? If there's not a market, do you have to help make the market? Because that will influence what kind of people you have to employ. Then the next thing you have to answer is, how much money will it take over what period of time? How long will it take you to break even? And what kind of profitability can you expect? So what kind of return can investors expect if things work out according to the plan? And then lastly, you have to ask, do you have a good management team? Or if you don't have the management team in place, are you going to get certain people to make sure you fill out the management team? So those are the important questions you have to be ready to answer when you talk to potential investors. Then what I generally do, I know a lot of VCs, I know a lot of angel investors. I will start talking to them, get their feedback, because they give you valuable feedback about your project and your proposed company. And usually then I am able to find people who feel that this is an attractive thing that they want to invest in.
What are some of the ratios then when a company wants to get some venture capital or some investment capital? Sort of like you talk to 20 VCs and maybe one would be interested. Do you have a sort of a rough idea of what the kind of the percentage is?
Well, if you're in an area that's popular, in various things in the IT area which are very popular, you can usually find maybe 1 out of 10 who will be interested, or even 1 out of 4 or 5 who will be interested. When you move into a new area, we just began to move into the clean tech area, there weren't many VCs who understood that. And so it was a much broader search. to find VCs who understood the various materials issues, the various energy issues, who really understood that clean tech. Now, those many VCs are now developing that, so it's a little easier again. And I would say, in order to get funding for a company, you're really going to have to talk to 20 or 30 VCs.
And I guess you have the advantage that you have this excellent relationships network, so that you've built over a long history of success.
Well, it helps it go faster.
If you can share a story from your experiences as Chairman Emeritus of Borland Software Corp., sort of a legendary company from, you know, many decades, so.
Well, one of the important things that we learned at Borland was that sometimes having the best wasn't always the winner. Borland's response to competition was always to make their software better, and they made very good software. They were really good at it, and the developers loved the tools that they made, so they were very good at it. But making it better sometimes takes longer. And so often they were late to market, and people who had products that were perhaps not quite as good but had them earlier to market often did better. And so it's an important thing to understand the timing to market. It's not just having the best. You want to have the best you can get, but you also want to have the best you can get as early as you can get it.
Can you share one lesson from each of your prior positions, such as President and CEO of SRI International and so forth?
Well, I've held a lot of different positions, and I think I continued to learn from each one of them. One of the lessons I learned overall from all of them was that you often don't do what you thought you were going to do when you started. You find that, particularly when you take executive positions, that there are problems that have to be solved that you didn't anticipate. So you end up doing things that you didn't expect to do. When I went to SRI International, I didn't recognize that they had a financial problem that I had to solve before I could get on and solve some of the other problems of direction. But also, SRI was a great opportunity for me because I was able to direct it into more international activities. I opened it up to the Pacific. That was an important step. I was able to acquire the David Sarnoff Research Center from General Electric, which we turned into a for-profit corporation, the Sarnoff Corporation. So that was a great opportunity, and it's an important lesson of how do you integrate and how do you deal with an acquisition. That was one of the things I learned. As chairman and CEO of Sarnoff, the problem there was changing a corporate research lab into an independent, freestanding contract research organization so that people had to be able to market to many different audiences. And teaching the marketing of contract research was the real challenge there, which we surmounted. They did a very good job of it. One of the things that I enjoyed a great deal was the work with the organization, a nonprofit organization called Joint Venture Silicon Valley Network. And that was an organization was devoted to economic and social development of the region. And what I learned there was the importance of personal leadership, the leadership of senior executives and senior political figures. Joint Venture Silicon Valley had co-chairs, one from the private sector, one from the public sector. I was on the board for several years, and at my last board meeting, it was attended by the chairman of Hewlett-Packard, the chairman of Applied Materials, the chairman of Silicon Graphics, chairman of the Bank of America. They were there personally giving their leadership. They weren't sending their assistants. In many organizations, you get high-level names on the masthead of the organization, but they send their assistants. Here in Silicon Valley, these people were going and giving their personal leadership to the organization. So personal leadership was a really important lesson from Joint Venture. And there's a similar lesson from Smart Valley, which was was a creature of joint ventures. Smart Valley was introduced technologies into the schools. We had everything was smart. We had a smart schools program. We had a smart voter program. We had a smart permitting program. It was all, we used the masthead of being smart, but it was using technology to accomplish new things that help both the social as well as the economic aspects of Silicon Valley. I was also helped start an organization called the Center for Excellence in Nonprofits, and what we were trying to do there, and I think we succeeded to a considerable extent, was show nonprofits how to become more efficient, how to manage themselves better. Because nonprofits have an obligation to use the money well, which they receive. And we thought it was important to help teach the directors of nonprofits, many of them who had no management experience, teach them how to manage their organizations very well.
Okay, you also have some prior background, like Vice President of Research and Vice President Provost, championing establishment of the Office of Technology Licensing. That must have produced some interesting kind of insights when you did that.
Well, it was starting the commercialization program at Stanford, and particularly the Office of Technology Licensing, was an interesting challenge. And what was important there was the quality of the first director. The first director of that office was a person who understood very well what faculty researchers could do, but also what they could not do, the limits of what they could do, and then how companies could use that. He was a great person at developing these partnerships between what was happening in the university and what was happening in the companies. One of the most important things we learned was that if you're going to have a large amount of commercialization from a university, you have to have a lot of research. Many universities think that the commercialization, the licensing income that they get, the royalty incomes, will provide a good basis for research. It's really the other way around. If you don't have a lot of research, you won't have a lot to commercialize. And I think that's an important lesson for many, many universities.
You're also a founding partner of the first Mayfield Fund. Can you describe, you know, how that came about? And again, you know, sort of the insights that you gained from that experience.
Yes, I want to be a little more specific about that. I wasn't a general partner. I was a limited partner and advisor to the general partners. I was not full-time with the Mayfield Fund, but we were in the prospectus. There were four of us, I believe, maybe five of us, who were in this special role of being advisors and special limited partners. That was very early days for venture capital. One of the things which we often encountered was that technology people who had really great ideas but had no idea of how to turn that into a business. And we had to help them, teach them how to turn these technologies into business, finding the right kind of leadership and management team to create a real business out of that. Many of them felt that once they had the idea, they really already had a business, and there's so many additional steps. For me, it's a great learning experience, learning what it would take in order to really make that transition from an idea into a real business.
You know, you're a professor at computer science emeritus, Stanford University. In fact, your work at Stanford is legendary. Can you provide details of some of the most important lessons or some stories that you can share from your experience and your time at Stanford?
Well, there are a lot of interesting things that happened. It was a very exciting time because it was the beginning of computing. I helped start the first computer science department. I was recruited, actually, by the computer science department and the high energy physics department. Because it was between schools, Fred Terman, who was the provost and was a legendary person, was involved in my recruitment. He often would say that I was his last recruit because he retired shortly after that. He said that if I were to come, we would start the computer science department, which we did. There were six of us who were the founding members of the computer science department. So it was a time when computing was just taking hold in universities and in research centers around the world. It was, from that viewpoint, a very exciting time. I was able to help computerize the Stanford campus, and eventually led to things like the wiring of the whole campus, which now, of course, a lot of it is wireless. But it was the beginning of the introduction into many parts of the curriculum and many parts of the research centers of computing as a tool. And, for example, at the Stanford Linear Accelerator, where I was in charge of the what was called the computer group, we computerized that whole accelerator. And all the data analysis that was involved for the accelerator. So when experiments were done, they could rapidly analyze the experiments and understand what was happening in those particular experiments. So it was a really exciting transition time for the university, and I was happy to be a part of it.
Okay, you have a most distinguished history of considerable global contribution, impact, purpose, and significance over several decades, and you've won a plethora of awards. Which three awards or recognitions resonate most powerfully with you, and why?
Well, I was very pleased to win the Okawa Prize from the Okawa Foundation in Japan, because it recognized my early work and contributions to applied mathematics and the development of computers for the computers in the information technology area. And so recognition of your early work is always really pleasing, so that was very pleasing to me. I was awarded the Dongbaek Medal in Korea. It was awarded to me by the Republic of Korea from the president. And that recognized my work in helping develop the entrepreneurship in Korea, my work with some more than 200 young entrepreneurs, and which I was felt very rewarded by doing that. When I was elected to the Silicon Valley Engineering Hall of Fame, I felt a great pleasure at that, because that's your peer group recognizing you, and it's always great. Sometimes you have external people recognize you, but when your own peer group recognizes you, well, it's something that makes you feel good. So that was one which I felt particularly pleased with.
You must still be in touch with quite a wide network of entrepreneurs and young people who you've guided over the years. And that must be quite a rewarding experience when they contact you and say, you know, you made a significant difference. Can you share a story from that at all? Or?
Well, every once in a while I'll have someone that I haven't seen for a long time, a student who will come through, or a friend whom I helped start a company, who will relate to me how it did have an impact on them. I taught them how to do research, or how I inspired them to start a company. I don't have any particular stories that I could relate on that that immediately come to mind, but it happens to me fairly often, and sometimes unexpectedly people I haven't seen or heard from for a long time, and suddenly I'll get a contact and they'll say, well, I met you here at this particular meeting and I was very inspired by what you said. So it's kind of an ego trip when that happens.
You know, you've done a lot of global research. What five key lessons can you provide?
I think one of the important lessons is that you have to have the right conditions to... I spoke earlier about the features of the environment that we call the habitat. You have to have the right habitat to foster entrepreneurship. The importance of education, of course. Don't know any high-tech regions in the world that are successful that do not have some high-quality research or educational institutions present. I mean, that seems to be one of the most important prerequisites. And it permits new ideas to flow, but it also creates the talent, the workforce. Having the talent is really important.
Is there something surprising, unexpected, amazing, or humorous from all of the kind of travels that you've done and all the people that you met? Some kind of story that's kind of was unexpected?
Well, I probably found some that were unexpected, but I think the things that I have been most impressed by most is how rapidly things can actually change. When people are determined to make a change, they have a vision of how to make the change, and people are all working in that same direction, how rapidly it could change. We've spoken a lot about China, and I think the thing that has surprised me is how rapidly China has developed. And it's partly because there's a vision for it, and there's a will to do it, and I think it has developed rapidly. People often get discouraged. You go into regions in the world where things are not well developed. But once it starts changing, it's amazing how rapidly it can change.
In your view, what are the most serious roadblocks for businesses, and what are their solutions?
I think the hardest thing for businesses is how to manage change. If your product line is beginning to get old, when do you change to the new product line? You don't want to abandon your current one too quickly. And at the same time, you know you're going to have to adopt some new product lines. So when to make that change and how to make that transition, I think, is important. The other thing that's important is to understand where to find innovations. Innovation doesn't occur in one place anymore. It occurs in many different places. And now people talk a lot about open innovation, searching for innovations wherever you can find them anywhere in the world. I think that is an important lesson, and it takes an understanding of what's happening. We are seeing develop professionals whose sole job is to understand what technologies are developing elsewhere in the world that can be used within the company.
What do you think are the top technology issues presently facing businesses, and how do you propose they can be solved?
Well, I think one of the biggest issues that we face is the energy issue, because the demands for energy are going up as developing countries with large populations like China and India begin to move upscale, which they are doing. The demands for energy will be enormous. In fact, they already are enormous. And so solving the energy problem, I think, is solving in a way that's environmentally sound is the major overall problem that we face today. Other aspects of the environment are important. I think we have to have some new technologies. For example, in the energy area, there's a lot of coal available in many countries of the world, and people are moving toward coal as a basis of energy. But up to now, plants for generating energy from coal have not been very clean, and getting clean coal becomes a major issue. And there are technologies that are available for that. They're still very expensive. They have to be made less expensive. Finding less expensive ways to do that, I think, is important.
Again, because your background is so extensive and so diverse, and you've had such a great history, can you sort of look in your crystal ball and provide predictions of future business IT trends and their implications and opportunities?
Well, about 3 years ago, I read an article in The Economist magazine which said that it was going to be the cell phone or the mobile phone and not the PC that would bridge the digital divide. And it caused me to realize that the mobile phone is the most ubiquitous IT device in the world, and I believe it will become the primary IT device over time. Learning how to do things better. You have to do things differently on a small mobile phone than you do on the desktop. So there are many opportunities on the technology development side, on the content side, around the mobile, making things mobile. I was recently in Africa, I was in Kenya, for a particular program, but we also took a few days to go out into the game parks to do some game viewing. And I was literally sitting watching a mother cheetah with three cubs and getting my email at the same time. I was staying connected even while I was out there doing game viewing. So the impact of the mobile, that's in some ways a more amusing impact or more recreational one, but the impact of the mobile phone on for rural farmers for marketing and so forth, for fishermen when they're bringing in their catches to know which port is the best port to go to, the mobile phone is having a huge impact on the individual, but also on the individuals that are doing business.
Can you profile your work with the Cheetah Conservation Fund?
Yes, my wife and I have been very active in wildlife conservation for quite a number of years. We did some work with wolves in Minnesota, and then we started working with the cheetahs in Africa, and particularly in Namibia. There's a Cheetah Conservation Fund in Namibia, and there's also a Cheetah Conservation Botswana, which is a newer project. We spent most of our time on the Cheetah Conservation Fund in Namibia, where they have the largest population of cheetahs in the world. It's one of the most viable populations because it is so large. There are really four parts to the program. One part is scientific, studying the habitat, studying the prey animals, understanding how those change and how the cheetahs interact with it. So that's a scientific program. Another part is a relocation, where we capture cheetahs in areas where they're not wanted and move them into areas where they are wanted. There are a lot of farmers who do want them, but there's some who don't, so we move them. Then there's a major educational program, education for the schools. The center has a major, really lovely education building, the education of the farmers. And then the last part of it, which is in many ways the most successful, we raise a guard dog. This dog is bonded to the livestock when they're very young, when the dog is very young, and they protect the dog. They chase away predators like cheetahs, and then the farmers don't have to shoot them. And the farmers are saying, well, these dogs are 7 by 24, and they chase away the predators, we don't have to shoot cheetahs.
That's sort of an interesting kind of solution, isn't it?
Well, it is. And now the project in Botswana is going to try to do something similar with a different dog, but dogs that still can be bonded to the livestock. And so they're going to try a solution similar to that. But the farmers who have the dogs have been very happy because they don't feel they have to go shooting cheetahs because the dogs chase them away.
Again, your background is sort of diverse. Do you have any sort of topics of your choosing that you want to just do some commentary on?
Well, I think one of the things I've learned over time is that it pays to be optimistic. You have to be realistic about things, but it pays to be optimistic. Look for the good things that can be done as well as being aware of the bad things. I think people have a certain spirit of optimism are the ones who have a can-do attitude and will go get things done. And so my message to people is don't be discouraged. Look for ways to achieve what you want to achieve and be optimistic about it, realistic but optimistic about it.
Bill, you know, we will continue to follow your significant contributions to the world. You basically have impacted the fabric of history worldwide, and will continue to do so because you're so engaged and so involved. And we very sincerely thank you for sharing your time and your wisdom and your very deep insights with us today.
Well, it was enjoyable. I appreciate the opportunity, and People often ask me, how did I get to do so many things? And I say, well, the most important thing is to keep living. Keep healthy, keep living, and keep doing things.
Or in your case, also, you have such a fertile mind, so you're always looking for the new opportunity.
I think if I had been born 400 years ago, I would have been an explorer.